5 years at an HIV negative test to study. Is that so?
Is it ever? I thought it made it.
It seems like it was, yeah, about 1970.
I read it ever. It says in one spot, ever. Ever.
Yeah, have you ever shot a skin puppy in your bees? If yes,
subject ineligible is what it has on the question.
Right, I didn't have a question.
That's interesting, because I have a question out of women who have been recovered for many years, and since then, because their partners are they're still seeing the same type of men, have become infected sexually.
Right.
You know,
We went back and forth about this for a long time, and we chose the conservative approach of excluding drug users, IV drug users.
But you don't ask anybody about women's implantations, they don't know if they're heterosexual.
Correct, though we do, correct. However, in the couple study, we do ask about sex with women. We're hoping that in fact, if someone does in fact seroconvert, we're hoping we can go back and look more carefully at and ask them more questions about our sex with women.
In the upcoming couple study, because I didn't see it in the current.
There is in the CDC collaboration, there's one or two.
Yes, go ahead. In either of these, I read through this and I don't recall seeing that. I mean, I've heard, I haven't seen it myself, the MAC study goes into like details, hard details on sexual practices. Are there those kind of questions?
With
in
women
these?
Or with the questions focus on sexual practices with men?
Well, since we've already ascertained you're not asking about the, you know, sexual practices with women and you're looking at heterosexual transmission, are there detailed questions?
I don't know which versions you have. Yes, there are very detailed questions about sexual practices.
Well, the ones that I read just basically asked you whether you had vaginal, anal, or oral sex.
Correct.
With or without protection.
What we're trying to do in the couples is ask questions in terms of put it in a time frame.
Yeah, but that's not, to me, a detailed question about sex. I mean, the only other thing that you added was, like, bleeding during, you know, having sex during menses. But when I looked at it, no offense, but I said to myself, these are people who think that the only way to have sex is a missionary position and think that oral sex is, like, really out there. Because, I mean, I know there are people who have limited sexual, activities. I also know that a lot of people have much broader sexual activity than most researchers presume. But if it's seriously... You know, if you really seriously want to understand transmission, okay, then it seems to me, I know that in the MAC study, they asked an incredible range of questions.
But you have to, there's a couple of things to keep in mind. One is the MAC is a very different population. And we're, in these studies, we're seeing people every 6 months. My bias is that I'm not sure people can remember exactly what they did 6 months ago. What we're trying to get is some composite.
You can ask simple questions like, do you use a dildo? Does your partner come in your mouth?
We do ask.
You know, what? No, it's not. Not on the ones that I read through every HAD study that you sent me, every questionnaire, and I'm telling you, this is what it says. Mm-hmm. Have you had oral sex with or without a condom? Mm-hmm. That doesn't tell you whether someone came in your mouth. Mm-hmm. Okay, that just says with or without a condom. You ask about vaginal sex with and without a condom. You don't ask people if they pull before a man comes. Mm-hmm. Which is one method of contraception that people still use. Okay, you don't ask if people use dildos. You don't ask if there's finger or fist insertion. I mean, you don't ask about a lot of things that are very typical, I would say,
but again,
typical sexual practices.
From my perspective, we're not trying to study sexual practices. We're trying to study sexual practices that
could be transmission, yeah.
Right.
Well, those are all possible ways.
Or activities that involve bleeding, whether intentional or unintentional.
Yeah,
in the Canadian study, that the guy with the penile bleeding that had us all squirming. But, those are the things that they were following up on in their study in terms of transmission, at least. I mean, I know that at least as the CDC would have it, there's a sort of hierarchy of if you've ever had, vaginal or anal sex, that is the risk, and oral sex is like a much smaller risk, and they never divide oral sex into, coming in the mouth or not, which in the gay community is a huge, huge issue, and a lot of people draw the line right there in terms of safe sex or unsafe sex. There's just a lot of, there's a much broader range out there, and if you look at, you know, the various different safe sex guidelines, that, I mean, every agency in the country seems to have different safe sex guidelines when it comes to women, and so it's getting mad.
The questions also didn't ask about bleeding during anal sex. I mean, they asked about vaginal intercourse during menses. And then there's like a general question about, you know, on one of them about, you know, sex with blood, but it's like very, you know, I mean, when I read it, I felt like it was about people not being able to ask the questions because they thought the people wouldn't answer the questions. Mm-hmm. But my own basic feeling then is don't do the research, because if you don't set up the kind of a relationship with the women that you're interviewing and the men that you're interviewing, where these things can be discussed, and I wouldn't trust anything on here, because why would someone tell you about drugs? I think it's only a particular kind of hang-up in this culture that you think that the thing that people would lie about is sex. But in fact, you know, I mean, given that there's been really some nice feminist research about lying, okay, mm-hmm. and about lying as a protection that women use in exactly those kind of research situations in which they don't trust the goals or the intentions of the researchers. And, you know, and to look at lying as not as something deviant, but in fact something that women have learned to do to protect themselves. So it seems to me that some kind of a situation has to be worked out in this interview stuff that is different than gay men.
It goes both ways. It's not just withholding information.
No.
It's constructing stories that
right.
the researcher wants to hear.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen the anthropologists really lead people on through all kinds
right.
of weird shit.
Well, I had one friend of mine did studies where she had, and it is a difficult question, but she had adolescents who peer interviewed other adolescents. This was in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had adults interview them, and part of it was about drug use. And, you know, they told two different stories,
right.
but what it was that to their peers, they bragged about using more, and to the adults, they talked about never doing it. Because it wasn't like one solved the question more than the other, but it just lets you know that in, when you're asking questions about people's intimate life, it can't be clinical in that sense, you know, and maybe there has to be some way found of doing those interviews, you know, because the truth is that in the Max study, they never got any good data. I mean, the reason
there's actually been a presentation at one of the next meetings where their ability to predict who converted was like 50-50. Their model, you know, toss a coin.
Really?
Yes.
It's so bad.
Based on sexual behavior.
Right, because they couldn't really get it. And then they had like a surrogate marker for effing anal sex, which was anal douching. You know, so people said yes to that, but no to anal sex. You know, so.
Hey. Something doesn't compute.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, okay, so when these women...
I just want to say one thing. The same thing is true about the drug stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you ask about sharing needles, but you don't ask about sharing cotton or water or anything like that. I mean, there's nothing specific in there, so you don't know if, really, where that's coming from.
Oh, yeah, and sometimes those cups are like pink or water.
Do you all have any initial data from these 500 women today?
That's only the...
What kind of information? Any kind?
Yeah, or like just a review of how the interviews are going, or what do you think so far
okay.
based on...
There are... I don't know if I gave this to you...
Is that the abstract that I sent
right.
out?
There is, you know, what has come out of Brooklyn are some univariate analyses in terms of this many people answer this question this way. However, in terms of how the study is going, it is going fairly well. However, one of the problems is getting people to come back to follow.
What kind of, if you're approaching these women and who are at downstate, so they're getting some kind of care,
Maybe not necessarily.
If they're doing a clinic visit or something? What's the incentive
but
you're approaching
okay,
them and...
Yeah. There may be, because some of them, remember, are coming from the community as well, so they may not necessarily have any kind of medical or health care. The incentives for coming into the study are to get the medical history and physical exam to get referred if they have some medical problems. For example, if sexual transmitted disease, they're given treatment for that. Their incentives is their own.
Okay.
Because the problem is we can't we're really not allowed to give them mm-hmm. money, but we can say that we're reimbursing them for transportation. Mm-hmm. That's how we can give them something. And they're given, they're just going to clinic. So a lot of it, it's not a lot of real concrete.
I just said that they didn't pay. They didn't have any hesitancy.
Peter's talk? And Delwyn's talk? She said,
This was on Monday.
On Monday. There's been a change at NIDA. In the beginning, they felt really constrained. And then after a while, they found they couldn't do certain things.
One of the things that happened is some people who were doing studies, getting money from other sources to pay the people for doing the interview who are having much more.
They also found that if they gave them too much, then people totally didn't trust it.
Yeah.
Janice, you say that you have a problem with follow-up. So how then would you know the success rate of them not coming back for follow-up?
Okay, we do. We try to get people in every 6 months.
Okay.
So the information about seroconversion obviously can only be based on the people who are actually coming back.
Exactly.
So it is a problem. However, what in Brooklyn they've been doing is they've been calling people, they've been sending them letters, they've been physically following them. If somebody, and it's not necessarily working, even actually given up on the home visit,
some incentive to make sure they come back. I mean, I'm not talking
big money. Right, again, they're given money. If they come back for the follow-up visit, they are given money. But, you know, you can't physically drag somebody.
I'm driving. Who's running the study? Is it Harold?
No, it's Sheldon Ramsden.
I have to think of a way to have these people come, because then what's the sense of the study? You're not really...
Are people getting primary care there?
Well, they're getting a history and physical care. The study is providing them with some medical care.
But they get nothing else at the place.
They get money.
Okay, yeah. Now
because
the
money... Because they go to Kings County for the care.
That's right.
If they may go to Kings County for the care, I mean, they may not.
Well, do you have any sense of where... See, I'm trying to figure out, I mean, you know, one of my pet peeves is, you know, downstate being across the street from Kings County and NYU being next door to Bellevue and then people claiming they can't keep women. Right. Well, you know, I mean, if they took women in and let them use their facilities for their GYN, you know, for their health care as part of the study, they might get women coming. But, I mean, if you're not getting anything back, what's the point? So, you know, to me, I mean, one of the things, I mean, I have a lot of questions about that head study, but I mean, one of the things, if something's going to come out of the study at all, it might be getting women health care, okay, if nothing else. And so I think in a way it's very important to keep records like that. Where exactly are the women who are enrolling coming from? Yeah, and that should be part of what's reported out, you know. No, I didn't see it in one of
the...
What year did this start?
One of the abstracts showed that the recruitment from community-based... It showed that the recruitment from the community-based sites were much better in terms of retention. That's right. Even though there were smaller numbers, absolute numbers of women who came from there, that they stayed, whereas the ones who came from the medical clinics and the GYN clinics, you got a larger absolute number of people, but they left.
How are the investigators being paid with respect to enrollment?
In other words, if they went to a place like Health Force.
Wait,
I'm sorry. She's just asking. If they went to a place like Health Force, or they went to the Caribbean Women's Health Project, okay, they would get fewer women referred because those community projects have, relative to Kings County, a fewer number of women coming in, but if the women got enrolled, they would stay in the study. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if they were referred by a doctor at Kings County from the OBGYN clinic mm-hmm. across the street to downstate, they would refer more women.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, a larger number would come in to begin with, and then they would never come back.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, it just proves to you that your community-based sites are the places where you're going to get people who are going to stay in the research. Partly, I'm sure, because they trust the people who are sending them over there.
When did this HAP study start?
It started in December. December 1988, and it will end in December 1993.
1993?
So December 1993.
So that's, it's been 3 years this month.
Oh, nothing happened.
And you're going to have time.
And so that's like six times that folks have been, I mean.
Well, remember that people didn't get enrolled immediately. The study protocol and questionnaires had to be developed.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, enrollment didn't start until a year later.
So enrollment started '89.
Mm-hmm.
So we only have really two years, and they're seen six-month intervals.
Right, but just remember, not everyone is recruited. Not
at the same time.
Recruited. Right, so there's
right.
various.
So there may be only four or two couples or something that were initially enrolled that
correct.
Have been gone through.
More than
see,
one filing.
Four filings only.
Right.
So we really don't have much information back on this. But you already have data back? You said, but you don't have it with you?
We have some univariate analyses, for example, which tell
yeah.
you how compositely people answered the questions.
Oh, right,
we also
right,
have some
that
abstract.
Packet.
Well, this packet are the abstracts that were presented in the AIDS meeting forums
right.
from this study.
Yeah.
So it kind of, it is based on
but
what...
These abstracts are written. 6 months before the thing,
right.
and they're out of date.
The data
could be
yeah.
wrong. Everything could be, you know, whacked up there.
Well, because the database is constantly changing
yeah.
because as more people are being added, some of these things may change.
That's a very brief thought.
Correct.
You know, don't these sites give, on some what they
quarterly
do
they do give quarterly and annual reports.
Well, those would be more
and
I do have one more question with respect to how much money goes to the sites, who gets paid, do they get paid for not only the initial enrollment but continuously for that person? You know, I mean, how is it broken?
Okay,
you know what I mean? You know, are they really doing the job? If they're losing half the women, you know, and then still get already got their money, you know, they don't
care when
the women leave. You know, that's less work for them.
Well, but they do because they have to. I mean, the money is not contingent per se on how many people they enroll. However, if they're not very productive, that's certainly going to have repercussions in terms of them ever getting money for more studies. I mean, if they've been in the study and they haven't recruited anybody, it's a factor.
If they recruit somebody in the initial,
yeah.
and then they blame the lack of follow-up on the woman,
yeah.
Right. which certainly happens, right? I mean,
yeah.
that blame is certainly
right.
there.
It's difficult, isn't it? But, right, I mean, yeah.
yeah.
and from
and
my
then
point
they
of view,
say,
I'm totally
yeah, well.
Jaded because I have seen so many people get their grants renewed who have done nothing that I can't even believe that if they did nothing, they wouldn't necessarily get refunded because it depends
yeah.
on who's on the review committee. And people make up excellent stories. I've read those things. I've sat on the review committee and they lie.
A lot of people are upset about that, actually, whether they're in the government or not. I mean, throughout the whole research community, everybody's upset about those videos.
Well, I know agencies must be upset.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I heard CDC saying, you know, when they gave money to the city, or as an invasion, that they didn't enroll people. They should come to see their study.
Sure.
But what did you do with TV? It was a TV
study.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, there's no accountability, you know. You got the money, what did you accomplish, et cetera. You know, there has to be straightforward answers that the public can get and you can get.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can't give me, you know, some answer, well, you know, this population is hard to deal with, you know, and all this stuff, and they drop out, and all this, you know.
I think there's been a general move towards having early milestones so that people can know if this thing should be aborted right away. I think more and more the agencies are really trying to do healthier trends around.
I know that we're gonna try to do site visits at these places before, you know, we fund these new WIC sites and why sites.
I had a question on that.
My question is just that in terms of abstracts for
but whoever
the data coordinating center is in charge.
One of the things that I didn't get from this clearly is those 500 women. Now I know that that the question that you asked at the beginning is, you know, have you taken an HIV test, and are you HIV positive, but I also know that you, since you don't do a test at that moment, that you, no, I mean, but you don't get the information right away that you enroll women,
right.
And that there's a peculiar wordage at the beginning which basically says that the inclusion criteria is not being nor knowing, or knowing whether you are HIV positive. It's not that you're not HIV positive.
Right.
So how many women do you have who come into this who you then find out are HIV positive? Has that been increased since this point? That's the first question.
No, there actually have not been a lot. Which abstract
do you have? I have the one that you gave at Florence that was on crack and cocaine use by the history. And so I was just, you know, here, like, there were,
I don't know off the top of my head. I know that in general it is not been
right. Well, I mean, I find real problems with what has gotten published on this, because it doesn't seem to me like it's telling the truth about the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there are an incredibly small number of HIV-positive women in the study. Secondly, there's a chart here that shows, in fact, a very peculiar relationship between crack and cocaine use and being HIV positive, which is if you never do it, or if you do it greater than weekly, you have the lowest percent. Okay.
Well, again, we're looking at this. There's 140.
I'm telling. I know exactly. Okay. And then if you do it less than monthly, it's 0%. I mean, they have like 3% and 4% and 0% of people in the center. And then if you do it less than weekly, but, you know, this is crack and cocaine, then that has the highest percentage. I mean, the scale shows nothing. But in the conclusion, okay, based on a minimum number of people, you know, without any kind of a consistent pattern, what they claim is that you're at high risk for HIV. And
no, that's not what it says. It says that women have an increased risk of unrecognized STDs, including HIV.
It says, in addition to being at high risk for STDs, comma, including HIV, comma, a history of greater than weekly crack of
cocaine. I'm looking at a different one than you are, sorry.
Well, the one that you're looking at may be the one where they then, in order to get statistical significance, collapse the group that was less than monthly or never against the group that was less than weekly and more than weekly. And if they do that, what do you know? It's statistically significant.
Right.
Okay. But, I mean, this is putting this, I read this, and, I mean, there was no information in this that seemed useful,
mm-hmm.
you know, at all for the amount of time the study has been going. And so I don't know why anyone is being refunded. I mean, to tell you the truth, you know, this is data on STDs in these women who are not HIV positive.
Right, but that's the problem. If you don't have, the problem is when this study was first conceived back in 1986 and 1987,
right.
We thought there were going to be a lot of women who seroconverted. It didn't turn out that way, so we're left in a situation where all these high-risk HIV negative women who are
negative. So you're doing STD studies, but you know, in New York we have STD clinics. They have better data on seroprevalence. And in fact, they have better data on STDs. I mean, those things are things that people have been coming to those clinics for forever, so why would we spend the money to do this size of research, including this many women, okay, basically to get data on STDs? And the studies that are being done on crack and cocaine use, they're being done by NIDA. So, I mean, it just seems to me that in terms of focusing and having, you know, sort of priority research areas and stuff, I don't understand what this is contributing.
I think one thing that, you know, Janice has settled with the project officer job on a study that is set in motion that doesn't have a good mechanism for shutting it off if it's not productive. They have to make what they can of it.
And the other thing, keep in mind, it's not going to be refunded. There's going to be a different study,
okay.
and it's not. Right. It's up for grabs in terms of who's going to be funded. It's going to be a
process. This is one of the things where we hope to change that in the future, where there are immediate milestones. You know, if the study's not going to work out, you find out right away. But I think that study is part of that old system that didn't have these good, you know, the more realistic and flexible setup.
And also, if it helps at all, it has been certainly been cut back. From what was planned to be
understand, because she's been shedding blood, sweat, and tears trying to get something out of the thing. I mean, she's been put in a horrible position. I just have to let you know.
But I think that the good thing that came out of here was that with the education that the woman got, you saw that that's excellent information in and of itself, so that you can use that to say maybe we should put more money into something that will get these women.
Maybe should be pounding the public health service or somebody over their head.
Remembering where I come from, you know, in my community, women who don't have information and access to that information, and I don't mean just a one-shot deal, don't wear a condom and you'll be fine, consistent and regularly and, you know, at their cultural level, and it's, you know, embedded in them or repeated consistently, there becomes a difference then. And I, you know, that's what we've been screaming out for so long. You know, come down here, give us this on a consistent level. Because you don't just hear it one time and expect for the person. You know, and even with that, as we've been seeing, even with the consistent, if you slack off for a while, they'll kind of go back. I mean, because all they've been doing all their lives. Come on, let's go.
But that's a good thing. My question about that is, and you know, people just have to take it as not, I mean, I know you don't run the study, and I know you're a staff.
Drugs that mom was using during pregnancy, although it's not really known what trimester it really captured, it's thought to be more of a cumulative measure of what she's been taking during pregnancy. And actually, we're hoping to shed some light that in the HIV-infected kids, that the reason why these kids aren't growing well is not because they're HIV-infected, but because, you know, of other drugs that mom is using.
No one knows.
And no one knows because
year of like
a very
writing protocol.
To do,
I'll be happy to I'll be happy to share that with you if you request it. And what, you know, I think it's going to shed a lot of light because what the perinatal studies have not consistently shown is that HIV infection causes adverse neonatal outcomes like failure to thrive and other things. And that's a hypothesis that's been thrown around for so many years that people assume that it happens even though it's not been proven in the literature. And the only people who have shown the opposite, that is without what we've known before, still stands that if mothers use drugs during pregnancy, that in a dose-related fashion, they were able to demonstrate among HIV-infected babies that it mattered whether you used drugs during pregnancy and whether the baby was in withdrawal at delivery. That, you know, that came out. A lot of our studies in the U.S. are not
right away.
That
just
way.
Look at this other picture.
Thank you.
What about support groups? Community advisory boards with these studies. Also, with regard to, you know, if you had a support group and then you have a person who would help keep contact with people in the study, a small kind of, you know, more than one person, keeping contact with people in the study, helping that follow-up thing. Do the people in the study get information on what's going on with the study? For example, what are the results, what has come out of this, et cetera?
Yes, we do that in those
But getting the people, some of the people involved, and they maybe even paying them a little more with respect to keeping up with getting people, you know, their expenses, for say if they had to go to meetings, extra meetings, and so forth. You know, volunteers are sometimes used to keep contact with certain groups of people, like a cancer study, where you know, certain people in the study, and then you keep contact with them on a regular basis, or fill out for various forms and see what they've done. You know, in order to you know, help the follow-up business. Are they kept as separate individuals when they go in there, or do they know that other people are involved? Is there any, you know, group involved.
Are you talking about hats?
Yeah,
well,
hats.
Either
yeah.
Well, hats or, you know, it doesn't make any difference.
What's eventually going to be
you know,
Liz?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, either.
It's different, like Liz. It's different than hats or Liz.
If you could say the pros and cons of for that type of
mechanism to follow up and keep people involved, whether it was for WITS or whatever. I mean, I'm sure there may be pros and cons for why it can't be done in one situation and another.
One of the things that I like about some of the so-called natural histories, I really love the ban that term, the infection studies, women who are infected. Some of the studies on their own, because they're very connected with the communities and with the patients, try to get buddy groups set up so that each person's matched with a buddy will help them through the system, help them. So they call if they need to get to the hospital or if they need to get back to the clinic. So it's a great way to do it.
Perhaps. You're 65% that's the Brooklyn, right. I assume that's the score. The couple study is different.
The couples is generally better because, for a reason, there's more, and part of the study maybe involves the different people. I mean, in Brooklyn, just about everything, the innovative things that they did on one day and schedule up, they had a couple people to say, I think, for whatever reason, it worked.
I just want to say,
it's just
break in a few minutes so that you can stretch and get
some
air.
What the sites do is just try anything that they can think of that seems like work and then sort of keep track of what works. But it's kind of difficult. You're dealing with coaches that kind of them don't have.
Just say that there are so few support groups for women in the United States of America. That if you ran an epidemiology study, a part of which was arranging and for and facilitating support groups for the women who came, in a particular location. I'm not talking like they all have to be at the same hospital, but you actually had as part of that the research center had to, if they couldn't do it themselves, subcontract out to a local women in HIV group or a local community group to run support groups that women could come to, in a range of neighborhoods. That's the kind of thing, that is going to make a difference.
Yep.
And it's definitely going to affect the research, because once the women start talking to one another, in addition to whatever you're telling them, obviously they're going to learn things from one another, but that's life. I mean, there's no way you're going to find out I know that 3/4 of the research in the world that involves human beings is based on either a captive university undergraduate population or a captive prison or mental institution population or a captive military population or those people who are terminally ill and strapped to a bed in the hospital and someone offers to put them on a study. So
captivity.
Really? Does that sound familiar? So, it's no surprise to me that, that it is hard to get any person, and that's why it often offends me when people act as if it's the problem with this particular group of women. It is not. People have a really hard time. I mean, Nielsen doesn't send you a dollar in the envelope because people reply. They send out millions of dollars across the United States because they know they've got to pay people even to answer about their television watching. So, so I don't think we can blame it on the people or anything. It's the nature of why would you be in a research study, really? Ask yourself. I know, I don't enter them.
There's no good reason unless you get something.
Well, unless I get something or unless somebody can really convince me that it's worthwhile.
The other thing is that somehow from the beginning so you're going to get some information.
Yes, well, that's what I mean about worthwhile. I mean, I don't, I think lots of times people are offended by being offered money.
Yeah.
And I don't mean for transportation, I mean they feel offended that you would think, because I think most people would like to contribute to knowledge and they would like to do what they think to be a worthwhile study. But my problem is that most of the studies that anyone has ever described to me that they've asked me to be a part of, I could not figure out what was worthwhile about them.
And when you go into one of these places and it's done in this kind of hospital and you first come in and then that, you have this person or this place that they have all this money and all this, that doesn't balance out. Now you have somebody who's doing research and automatically the field is like, they're like this and I'm like that.
Yeah.
You're not going to get, that level of thing. And I'm not saying, there's, later on I want to talk about how, I belong to another organization called Health Force, Women Against AIDS, who does community work in the community. And we all up here educated, and we go out and we do support and education and prevention in a peer form. And you can kind of get across at a level where people kind of, they feel comfortable
with it. That's actually why I think groups work, because I think eventually the group
we have to give people stipends. People are getting money in the same thing to go to the ACCG,
right,
et cetera. Other people should be able to get that. I mean, you know, it's just, if they have three kids and have to bring the three kids,
yeah,
whatever,
yeah,
it's going to cost them money. It's out of their pocket.
No, I said chance to, you know, if you...
Yeah.
But oftentimes in research studies,
a substantial amount, depending on you know, so they should, you know, get what the average is. If it's $30, that's
the other thing is there could be an incentive at the end for if this research is finished. You know, you're not offending them in the beginning by giving them, but you're telling them at the end of this study you can get X amount of this.
Well,
that's a way of
I think it also has
to do with sort of the sensitivity during the study, though, like the language, like. How the woman presents,
right?
Presents, you know. And granted, in this room, you know, we're educated. We know what we're talking about with that.
Mm-hmm.
But to the common person, if you say, "Well, you're presenting," you know, da da da, and all of a sudden it becomes a woman's responsibility on how the virus is presented in her. And I don't think, I mean, and a lot of times I have to.
You're thinking of herself. I'm making it impersonal.
Yeah, the sensitivity of the language,
mm-hmm.
and I just try and base it on my own personal experiences. But when I first heard that, how the woman presents, I thought, what, her clothing presents what, you know? And then I realized what people were trying to say is how the virus is presented in this particular woman or man or whatever. So part of it coming back, after you think you're not getting anything, and then you feel like you have been belittled, or it is on your shoulder responsibility, your shoulders, or your responsibility to present in a right way, and you have no idea how you're supposed to be presenting, or what that even means, I would think that that would be yet another speed bump to coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So, the beginning, the incentive at the end, and all that stuff that goes on in between is that dehumanizing, you know, this clinical atmosphere, you're here as a study and you're not presenting this, or you are presenting that, or,
let's take a break.
Yeah.
So the people who smoke can smoke.
And
all right.
Well, actually, I have a 12 o'clock. Xerox copies later. Our machine is not
this
doing
is a CPCRA ODB?
Right. And ODB is one of the protocols in the CPCRA, and what it stands for is the Observational Database. And right now, there are about 3,600 people enrolled in the Observational Database, and what that is a set of demographic, clinical diagnostic, treatment-related questions that we ask them, and then also a clinical assessment of the HIV-infected person when they get to their clinic, and they're assessed by their physician. Within the context of the CPCRA, there are clinical trials that are being done, and there's a toxo protocol that's being done, and it was amended so that there were 360 people in a toxo, in the whole toxo protocol. And in the new amended version, 320 of those people are in the new amended version. Then there's a protocol of DDI versus DDC in people who are ZDV intolerant, or failures, as it were. And there are 467 people enrolled in that. And some of the other studies that are being done is there's going to be a TB study, and there's going to be a fungal prophylaxis study in women. Well, I'm not directly involved in it. You are definitely involved with those protocols.
004, 005. One is for people who are PPD positive, and one is for people that are allergic. The drugs are INH versus
rifampin and EVA, those are two regimes. One is a short-term regime. Of course, the idea is that people are not compliant with the long-term therapy that has to occur, which is INH-type therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a two-month regime on the other two drugs.
The rifampin?
That's
been good in the UDP, but they have
pyrazinamide.
But they have people on methadone. They shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that in certain with people on methadone, the experts on methadone treatment and rifampin say that those actually has to be titrated up with respect to methadone. Because the liver is activated by rifampin, and it destroys the methadone, and the people go into withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
The people themselves can tell the investigator, "Well, I feel good now again."
Right.
Actually, the withdrawal symptoms start.
But are they willing?
And they can sort of increase those in somewhere about 50% more.
Are they willing to go as high up as 120 or something? Because
mm-hmm.
I know that.
Yeah.
Because rifampin just tears the stuff apart.
Yeah. You know? Well, it's called a drug methadone eater. They said 50%. Someone said 120 milligrams, but then somebody else said, it seems, I got the impression that there were certain experts that know how to do this, and that other sites would not know how to do this, or may not want to do this because of giving people more drug,
Most methadone patients are chronically underdosed to begin with, and a lot of times they don't know how to set the dosages, so. Even
so,
people who are
there's a problem with this particular protocol with respect to that that treatment.
Let's just talk about the ODB stuff.
Yeah, those numbers that you just read off, there's 362 people in the study. Can you quickly go over those again and say how many in the study and how many of those are women?
In the Plaxo study?
No, I'd rather stick with the.
Let's stick with ODB because I'm not involved with the clinical trial aspect of this. But as I go along, if I see the numbers, I'll share that with you. In the ODB, over 2,000 people have been followed up. 2,250 have been followed up. That is, they've had a longitudinal visit after their enrollment visit. And in terms of how well some of the sites are doing enrolling, in ODB, ARTC in Brooklyn has enrolled over 500 patients.
Mm-hmm.
You have mentioned that before. And Harlem has 300, and Chicago has 400, and Portland has 200, Detroit has 300. Two sites in Detroit, actually. One of them has 300, and the other one has 290. In terms of gender, 20% are women. 40% African American, 20% Latino.
That's women and that's overall.
That's overall.
How much percent Latino? Latina.
Latino.
Yeah, because these percentages are overall, they're not percentages
that's
of women,
right.
Like 40% black.
Latino
is
17.3%, African American is 40%, white is 42%.
Is that of the women or is that of the
That's overall.
So you don't break down the women according
yes,
to...
Yes, it's broken down later.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's the men and women.
White, non-Latino male is 39%. White, non-Latino female is 3%. Latino male, 12.5%. Latino female, Latina, 5%. Non-white male, 29%, non-white female, 12%.
Non-white female?
Non-white, meaning non-white, non-Hispanic.
Oh, black, because there is no Asians or Native.
Well, there may be. There may be.
Oh, so that's kind of like that other category?
There weren't any listed in there.
Well, this is stratified according to race and gender, and if you just want race ethnicity, there are 16% Latino, 42% African American, white, 42%. Asian Pacific Islander is 0.3%. Eskimo American Indian, 0.2%. Other, 0.7%. And that accounts for everybody.
You make a copy of that?
My Xerox machine didn't behave. So I'll get Maddie to make Xerox copies, and I'm going to be on that conference call, so just ask her for them.
When you go down, can you just give it to them?
Yeah, I'll give it to them. Okay, now that was for ODB, and if you want the percentages for toxo, 90% are male. And white, non-Latino, 44%, white, non-Latino female, 2%, Latino, Hispanic male, 20%, Latinas, 5%, non-white male, 25%, non-white female, 4%. Yeah. DDI, DDC, I can Xerox this all for you. So far, they've identified 11 PPD positive persons.
Well, the antiviral, much less women.
When I saw the stuff that you sent
us. No, it's basically 90% male, 10%.